Welcome back, everyone, to episode 2 of our 2-part podcast, Compliance Conundrums. Today, we're going to be talking about the evolution in compliance. I'm Bethany Hengsbach, Managing Director of Global Corporate Compliance at AMI. And with me again today are Jeff Eglash and Femi Thomas. Let me just briefly introduce Jeff and Femi again. Jeff, who among other accolades in his 35-year career, is the former Vice President, Deputy Chief Legal Officer, and Chief Compliance Officer at Nokia, as well as an Executive Counsel at General Electric, Inspector General for the Los Angeles Police Department in AUSA in the Southern District of California, Deputy DA in Los Angeles, as well as a partner in Big Law. Femi Thomas is currently the CCO of Booking.com, formerly Vice President and Global Head of Ethics and Compliance Business Integrity at Nokia. He's held various senior compliance and commercial roles at oil field products and services provider Weatherford and started out his career as a Big Law associate. So again, I'm thrilled to have both of these gentlemen back with us today. In our first Compliance Conundrum episode, we talked about the integration of cultures and we had what I thought was a fascinating discussion on that front. Because between the three of us, we have almost 100 years of compliance experience, we thought some historical perspective would be useful. And so today we want to talk about the evolution of compliance. And because the guests we have here with us today have so much experience in this area, I would really love to turn it over to them and have them talk about the evolution of compliance from their perspective. So Jeff, I'm going to start with you. Describe for us your compliance journey, the many different perspectives from which you've dealt with compliance throughout your 35-year career, and the most significant changes you've seen since you started practicing in this area.
Thanks. Thank you very much, Bethany. Thanks for the question. So compliance first became an issue for me when I was in AUSA, and a number of the cases that I was prosecuting involved businesses and business organizations. And this is, in the 90s, and I would say that compliance and a discussion around a corporation's compliance program or culture was little more than an afterthought in the discussions around resolution of those cases, whether it be by a pre-indictment disposition or plea agreement or even at sentencing. And, it just wasn't that we rarely talked about, we rarely thought about corporate compliance programs and what they did to prevent or detect compliance misses. It wasn't until the organizational sentencing guidelines came into effect and really started to play out in the interactions between prosecutors, defendants, and companies that there was a much more focus on companies and what companies were doing internally to ensure compliant behavior. Subsequently, I went to the LAPD as Inspector General, and I often find myself now wishing that I could go back in time and take some of the lessons that I've learned about what makes an effective corporate compliance program and see if they would apply and help ensure appropriate behavior and accountability and transparency at that police department. I think it would have been really interesting and valuable. When I got to the law firm now and moved up to sort of early 2000s, I remember vividly a partner approaching me and saying that a major retailer was interested in having somebody come in and help them adopt compliance programs. And I was asked, could I do that? And, like any good law firm partner with his salt, I said, of course, because who's going to turn down work? But it wasn't until, but then I realized sort of later as I got into my in-house responsibilities, I really didn't at the time know what were the elements of a corporate compliance. What was corporate compliance all about? And I was fortunate enough to go to GE, probably 15 more, coming up on 20 years ago. And that was really sort of, an incubator. They were an early adopter of the importance of compliance programs. I think that's what happens when your CEO gets sort of called before Congress and grilled about a compliance miss as happened at GE. And so I really was fortunate to sort of learn about compliance from the very best, from some pioneers in the field. And I think a lot of what we see now and talk about now in the compliance profession as being commonplace and conventional wisdom was, you know, were things that really were developed and refined at GE. So now what I'm seeing is interesting is, first of all, there's a common understanding across the compliance profession about what are the key components for, you know, effective compliance program. And of course, we've all been helped along the way by DOJ and other pronouncements from regulators and organizations about what are the ingredients. But another thing that I'm seeing too is that an understanding about the importance of a good compliance program and culture is now going beyond the corporate space. And I'm seeing, for example, universities in higher education understanding the importance of not just compliance, but risk and monitoring. I'm seeing it in government agencies and nonprofits as well. So I think there's recognition now in other types of organizations about the effectiveness and the value of having good compliance programs, and we're seeing them exported into other other settings. And I think that's a good thing.
You touched on your experience in government, but because you're the only one here who has experience from that side of the table, can you talk a little bit about how you see the evolution of compliance in the enforcement arena among the regulators?
I mean, there's no question, I think as we've all experienced being on the other side of the table, that the sophistication, the understanding, the awareness about what makes for a good compliance program has really increased enormously. I mean, I remember, I suspect many of us do, when the compliance expert from DOJ released her sort of list of questions that she's going to want to ask any company that's coming in seeking leniency in an FCPA or other major compliance case. And I remember thinking, wow, these are great questions. These can help guide us in shaping our program and prioritizing it and so forth. So I think before then, it was commonplace for companies that were facing prosecution to go into the regulators or prosecutors and talk, in, you know, happy talk about what a good program or culture they had and how seriously they took compliance. But I think what we've seen now are much more sophisticated and refined ways of really testing that and asking hard questions. And so the demands, the expectations on companies to prove that they've got the right processes in place and that any compliance miss is the result of, you know, sort of circumvention or something like that, rather than a direct result from a bad culture, has developed enormously.
Yeah, I've seen the same thing. And I think just the level of knowledge and sophistication on behalf of entities like DOJ is really striking. And I remember, you know, I started practicing in the late 90s as well. And there was almost no focus on compliance whatsoever. And I think along with that, not a whole lot of understanding about how compliance and a compliance culture then resulted in some of the activities that had caused the company to be before the DOJ. So I completely agree with you. Femi, what's your take?
So one of the things, or some of the things that I'm seeing as part of this evolutionary journey that are quite frankly encouraging are, we're seeing some chief compliance officers or former chief compliance officers getting on boards of public companies that you never saw that before, which is in itself a statement about what corporates now regard as essential skill sets for well-rounded boards. And then of course, the diversity now in terms of professional discipline. So this used to be a lawyers only club. And of course, now we have chief compliance officers that are accountants and that are data scientists and other sorts of disciplines. And that really is bringing a diversity of thought and experience that is essential to, you know, risk mapping and the development of corporate culture and all of the other things we've talked about or are talking about today and spoke about in the last session. So I think these evolutionary trends tell us a lot about the continued importance of compliance, as Jeff said, not only in the corporate sector, but in others in education, in nonprofit, but also about the growth in what it takes to be a successful chief compliance officer. It will not be the same skills and experiences of 10 years ago that'll get us to the next 10 years.
You know, Bethany, talk about that. Go ahead, Jeff.
I was going to say, if I may, I was just going to add one more trend that I'm seeing, which is that I think more and more sort of topics and areas of responsibility are now coming into compliance, whether compliance owns it or compliance is just a, you know, a very important part of the discussion. I think human rights and ESG issues are a great example of this, but increasingly there's recognition that regulatory domains should be looked at through the lens of a compliance. I think there's greater sort of convergence of the compliance function and the risk function. And, you know, maybe selfishly, but I actually think that this is a good thing and is a reflection of the fact that many compliance programs have proven successful at managing risk in an appropriate way. And so it's only natural that companies would want to take the rigor and the mindset that we as chief compliance officers bring to problems and bring these other emerging issues into the compliance fold as well.
You know, Femi, you mentioned non-lawyers as compliance personnel, and I think it's such an important point. And I think, you know, the three of us are lawyers, obviously, and I think, at least speak for myself, I think lawyers sometimes really at our peril underestimate the value that others bring. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit in terms of what you've seen. We discussed and you pointed out that this evolution has led to more non-lawyers in compliance. What are the benefits that you've seen from that?
So, you know, speaking about my team now, which is something like 60% other professionals and 40% lawyers, we're seeing the impact that the other professionals have based on their very different experience, sets of experiences and skills in shaping the way that lawyers approach some of the thornier or even the softer sides of compliance. There's been for a long time the very legal mindset of analyzing regulatory issues and arriving at a disclose, non-disclose, penalty, non-penalty sort of dynamic. And as Jeff said, you know, compliance seems to get more involved in things like human rights and ESG, in part because we've got more people in our teams who have some of those experiences, and in part because there's nowhere else in the organization for those things. And so I credit some of the diversity that we see in the chief compliance officer ranks, gender diversity, racial diversity, to some of the diversity that we're seeing in the professional disciplines. I think that's, in my mind, one of the greatest impacts of the you know, broadening of the scope of skills and qualifications required to lead a compliance organization is what it does for gender, racial, and other forms of diversity at the top of these organizations.
Jeff, would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I love bringing in people from various backgrounds and professions. Auditors, I think, you know, journalists, investigative reporters make great additions to compliance teams. I love bringing in people and bringing together. And I think that, you know, the benefit, the synergy that you get from bringing people with these diverse backgrounds and skill sets together is of great value.
I have the same perspective, actually, coming from a large law firm to a firm like AMI, where we're not just lawyers. I have a former CFO on my team. I have data analysts. And if anyone has had the experience of asking a first-year associate to read a balance sheet and how painful that is, you'll understand my perspective. The same thing that you guys are talking about. I think we as lawyers tend to be so insular. And really, again, as I said, it's our loss because all of these different perspectives, not just for the sake of diversity, but really in terms of the results, I think really just get us to a better place. Femi, you know, you in particular among us have some geographic experience that we don't have. You've been in many different parts of the world, and I'd love to hear your perspective on how compliance has evolved differently in those different parts of the world.
Yeah, as you said, I've lived across Africa, in the US, in the UK, now in the Netherlands, done a lot of work in Asia. And I think when we start to think about geographical influences on corporate culture, I think back to our last episode where we were focused on corporate culture within the organization. When we think about geographical differences, we now start to have to account for the external, the culture in the environment where the organization sits or where our warehousing or manufacturing, wherever it is. and what that culture, what are the key elements of that culture that impact or influence our own internal corporate culture. Remembering that the corporate culture of a large multinational organization was often drafted by people sitting in New York or in London or in Amsterdam, but then the operations are in Nigeria or in Malaysia or elsewhere. And there's often a delta between what we think we believe in and how that influences what we do every day and what you what obtains on the ground elsewhere. And so I've seen compliance programs really pivot from exercises of more hard power, right? So really strict rules around gifts and entertainment or other things in certain markets to different rules in other markets. Sometimes you have to flex in that direction. And also just thinking about the various people that we have to interact with as part of the compliance ecosystem will change from geography to geography. So in Europe, we've got strong works councils in countries like the Netherlands and Germany that you don't have in the US. And so when we think about the groups that we have to work with, that we have to convince, that we have to engage in the compliance journey, it'll often change from market to market. But what we have to be careful about is in setting global minimum standards, we've got to be careful to make sure that we've come to understand enough about the cultures in the countries that we operate in to where those standards do not become themselves a problem. You've set it to a high to where it's unwieldy, can't really get things done that you should be able to get done, or you've set it too low in order to accommodate the way it is done here, or this is just the way things are in this country, and you've exposed the company to risk unduly.
Interesting. And Jeff, I know you have some geographic experience as well. So what's your take?
Well, I mean, obviously, you've got to be cognizant and as chief compliance officer, think about some of the cultural challenges. For example, in some countries, particularly in Asia, you're just not going to get the cooperation that you need in terms of employees reporting. There's, you know, such a disincentive or a tradition against reporting, or, you know, there may be a tradition of going along with whatever your manager or supervisor says and just following rather than questioning or challenging, right? A successful compliance program requires employees to be prepared to speak up and to challenge things which don't seem right. That may come up against, you know, longstanding cultural norms that that inhibit that. You may be dealing with regulators or enforcement officials in other countries that just don't sort of operate the way we in the US might come to expect. I mean, I had a number of discussions when we had misses in foreign countries with outside counsel about approaching the authorities and disclosing and indicating what had happened and what we were going to do to fix it. And they said, if you do that, they will look at you like you're from another planet, right? Nobody would come in and sort of, you know, confess their sins. And so you have to tailor your response plans depending on the traditions and norms of the country or the geography in which you're operating.
Jeff, another really interesting example from our time together was this feedback from largely employees in Europe about investigations programs and how those function or should function. And it was the first time really that I was hearing employees in any market, but this seemed to be a quintessentially European context or concept, that when I raise a concern, I'm not always looking for an investigation. Sometimes I just want somebody to mediate an issue between people. But when I think the only outcome is that email from the investigator and then that phone call, then multiple interviews and then document reviews, I might not raise any concerns because I feel like the investigations program is, you know, it's like bringing a machine gun to a fist.
I agree completely with all of that. We only have a few minutes left. And in the remainder of our time, I'd just like to talk about this question of the evolution of compliance in terms of differences in industry. So just on our podcast today, we have tech, we have hospitality, we have oil and gas. And Femi, I'll turn it over to you first. How have you seen compliance evolve in different industries?
The differences have been pretty stark. So as you've mentioned, I started out my in-house career in the oil and gas space, which because of the number of FCPA investigations over a long period of time, because of the number of health and safety issues, you have a very different discipline around compliance process. I'm not saying that compliance programs are better in the oil and gas sector. I'm just saying there's a different process discipline. Think about health and safety. If you haven't done your health and safety training, you cannot get on an oil rig. Doesn't matter how important the work is. And you're seeing, or you saw more and more chief compliance officers in the oil and gas space taking that mentality and leveraging that to get buy-in from senior leadership about the importance of mandatory training. But then you go over to the tech side, it's a very different culture. You've got, you know, different demographics, much younger. You've got product complexity that really makes it very difficult to find that transparency of understanding how do we develop this product, who gets involved in it, how does it get from here to the hands of the consumers. That product complexity can be a risk in and of itself. And then, you know, I've mentioned before this agility pressure that you see in the tech, more in the tech industries that you don't see in the heavy industries. And so these different contexts around, you know, better risk preparedness and process discipline in the heavy industries or the extractive industries versus, you know, agility pressures and product complexities in the tech industry really mean that our compliance processes can never be one size fits all.
Jeff, your thoughts?
Well, you know, I have some interesting thoughts on this because when I was at GE, I was at GE corporate. And so that meant I got to work with all of the different GE businesses and they had quite a range, right? They had aviation, healthcare, oil and gas, NBC broadcasting. And so I got to see really a range of differences in terms of how each of those businesses approached compliance. Now, fortunately, GE was really good about making sure from the top down that the, you know, essential elements of compliance and the understanding of the importance of compliance carried through. But nevertheless, there were major differences that I saw. For example, Femi mentioned safety. Well, at the nuclear business at GE, I saw that at every meeting, at every level, they start every single meeting with a safety message. And of course, you would hope and expect that that's the case, given that they're in the nuclear power business. Similarly, the aviation business took compliance incredibly seriously because the consequences of a failure in aviation obviously are enormous. Healthcare and you know, GE Capital were heavily regulated. And so that obviously had a big impact on how they viewed compliance and the resources that they needed to bring to bear to compliance. Other businesses, you know, it was a little bit more, you know, loosey-goosey, whether it was NBC, as I mentioned, or in the energy or oil and gas space. They didn't have quite the same rigor, but fortunately, as I said, the message about integrity was pretty good about coming from the top down and okay. did get through, I think, to people at every part of the organization.
Well, unfortunately, that brings us to the end of our time today. Thank you, Femi and Jeff, for joining us again. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us for our inaugural Compliance Conundrum podcast. I really hope it's not our last. I've been sitting here listening to you two, thinking about so many new topics that I'm interested in, would love to hear your thoughts on. One of them that I've been thinking about a lot lately is a lot of us sort of cut our teeth in compliance on the FCPA days. We've made reference to that a lot during these podcasts. And I always think about the positives and the negatives of that, of building a program based on that subject matter area. So perhaps that's a subject for another day. But thank you again for joining us, Jeff and Femi, and thank you again to all of our listeners.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.